Ulysses by James Joyce. Stately plump Buck Mulligan came from the stairhead, bearing a bowl of lather on which a mirror and a razor lay crossed. A yellow dressing gown, ungirdled, was sustained gently behind him by the mild morning air. He held the bowl aloft and intoned, "Introibo ad altare Dei." Halted, he peered down the dark winding stairs and called up coarsely, "Come up, Kinch! Come up, you fearful Jesuit!" Solemnly he came forward and mounted the round gunrest. He faced about and blessed gravely thrice the tower, the surrounding country, and the awaking mountains. Then, catching sight of Stephen Dedalus, he bent towards him and made rapid crosses in the air, gurgling in his throat and shaking his head. Stephen Dedalus, displeased and sleepy, leaned his arms on the top of the staircase and looked coldly at the shaking, gurgling face that blessed him, equine in its length, and at the light, untonsured hair, grained and hued like pale oak. Buck Mulligan peeped an instant under the mirror, and then covered the bowl smartly.
"Back to barracks," he said sternly.
He added, in a preacher's tone,
"For this, O dearly beloved, is the genuine Christine, body and soul and blood and oons. Slow music, please. Shut your eyes, gents. One moment. A little trouble about those white corpuscles. Silence, all."
He peered sideways up and gave a long, low whistle of call, then paused a while in rapt attention, his even white teeth glistening here and there with gold points. "Chrysostomos." Two strong, shrill whistles answered through the calm.
"Thanks, old chap," he cried briskly. "That'll do nicely. Switch off the current, will you?"
He skipped off the gunrest and looked gravely at his watcher, gathering about his legs the loose folds of his gown. The plump, shadowed face and sullen oval jowl recalled a prelate, patron of arts in the Middle Ages. A pleasant smile broke quietly over his lips.
"The mockery of it," he said gaily. "Your absurd name, an ancient Greek."
He pointed his finger in friendly jest and went over to the parrot, laughing to himself. Stephen Dedalus stepped up, followed him wearily halfway, and sat down on the edge of the gunrest, watching him still as he propped his mirror on the parapet, dipped the brush in the bowl, and lathered cheeks and neck. Buck Mulligan's gay voice went on.
"My name is absurd, too. Malachy Mulligan, two dactyls. But it has a Hellenic ring, hasn't it? Tripping and sunny like the book himself. We must go to Athens. Will you come if I can get the aunt to fork out 20 quid?
He laid the brush aside and, laughing with delight, cried,
"Will he come, the jejune Jesuit?"
Ceasing, he began to shave with care. "Tell me, Mulligan," Stephen said quietly.
"Yes, my love."
"How long is Haynes going to stay in this tower?" Buck Mulligan showed a shaven cheek over his right shoulder.
"God, isn't he dreadful?" he said frankly. "A ponderous Saxon. He thinks you're not a gentleman. God, these bloody English. Bursting with money and indigestion because he comes from Oxford. You know, Dedalus, you have the real Oxford manner. He can't make you out. Oh, my name for you is the best. Kinch, the knife blade."
He shaved warily over his chin. "He was raving all night about a black panther," Stephen said.
"Where is his gun case?" "A woeful lunatic," Mulligan said. "Were you in a funk?"
"I was," Stephen said with energy and growing fear. "Out here in the dark with a man I don't know, raving and moaning to himself about shooting a black panther.
You save men from drowning. I'm not a hero, however.
If he stays on here, I'm off." Buck Mulligan frowned at the lather on his razor blade. He hopped down from his perch and began to search his trouser pockets hastily.
"Scutter!" he cried thickly.
He came over to the gunrest, and thrusting a hand into Stephen's upper pocket, said, "Lend us a loan of your nose rag to wipe me razor." Stephen suffered him to pull out and hold up on show by its corner a dirty, crumpled handkerchief. Buck Mulligan wiped the razor blade neatly. Then, gazing over the handkerchief, he said, "The bard's nose rag, a new art colour for our Irish poets, snot green. You can almost taste it, can't you?" He mounted to the parapet again and gazed out over Dublin Bay, his fair oak-pale hair stirring slightly. "God," he said quietly, "isn't the sea what Algy calls it, a grey, sweet mother? The snot-green sea, the scrotum-tightening sea, epi oinopa ponton. Ah, Daedalus, the Greeks, I must teach you. You must read them in the original. Thalata, thalata, she is our great sweet mother. Come and look." Stephen stood up and went over to the parapet. Leaning on it, he looked down on the water and on the mailboat clearing the harbour mouth of Kingstown. "Our mighty mother," Buck Mulligan said. He turned abruptly his great searching eyes from the sea to Stephen's face. "The aunt thinks you killed your mother," he said. "That's why she won't let me have anything to do with you." "Someone killed her," Stephen said gloomily.
"You could have knelt down, damn it, Kinch, when your dying mother asked you," Buck Mulligan said. "I'm Hyperborean as much as you, but to think of your mother begging you with her last breath to kneel down and pray for her, and you refused. There's something sinister in you."
He broke off and lathered again lightly his father's cheek. A tolerant smile curled his lips. "But a lovely mummer," he murmured to himself. "Kinch, the loveliest mummer of them all." He shaved evenly and with care, in silence, seriously. Stephen, an elbow rested on the jagged granite, leaned his palm against his brow and gazed at the fraying edge of his shiny black coat sleeve. Pain, that was not yet the pain of love, fretted his heart. Silently in a dream, she had come to him after her death, her wasted body within his loose brown grave clothes giving off an odour of wax and rosewood, her breath that had bent upon him, mute, reproachful, a faint odour of wetted ashes. Across the threadbare cuff edge, he saw the sea, hailed as a great sweet mother by the well-fed voice beside him. The ring of bay and skyline held a dull green mass of liquid. A bowl of white china had stood beside her deathbed, holding the green sluggish bile which she had torn up from her rotting liver by fits of loud groaning, vomiting. Buck Mulligan wiped again his razor blade.
"Ah, poor dog's body," he said in a kind voice. "I must give you a shirt and a few nose rags. How are the second-hand Greeks?"
"Oh, they fit well enough," Stephen answered. Buck Mulligan attacked the hollow beneath his underlip.
"The mockery of it," he said contentedly. "Second leg, they should be. God knows what poxy bells you left them off. I've a lovely pair with a hair stripe, grey. You look spiffing in them. I'm not joking, Kinch. You look damn well when you're dressed."
"Thanks," Stephen said. "I can't wear them if they're grey."
"He can't wear them," Buck Mulligan told his face in the mirror. "Etiquette is etiquette. He killed his mother, but he can't wear grey trousers."
He folded his razor neatly, and with stroking palps of fingers, felt the smooth skin. Stephen turned his gaze from the sea and to the plump face with its smoke-blue, mobile eyes.
"That fella I was with in the ship last night," said Buck Mulligan, "says you have GPI. He's up in Dottyville with Connolly Norman, general paralysis of the insane."
He swept the mirror a half-circle in the air to flash the tidings abroad in sunlight now radiant on the sea. His curling, shaven lips laughed, and the edges of his white, glittering teeth. Laughter seized all his strong, well-knit trunk.
"Look at yourself," he said. "You dreadful bard."
Stephen bent forward and peered at the mirror held out to him. Cleft by a crooked crack, hair on end. "As he and others see me, who chose this face for me, this dog's body to rid of vermin? It asks me, too.
I pinched it out of the skivvy's room, Buck Mulligan said. It does her all right. The aunt always keeps plain-looking servants from Malachy. Lead him not into temptation. And her name is Ursula. Laughing again, he brought the mirror away from Stephen's peering eyes. The rage of Caliban at not seeing his face in a mirror, he said. If Wilde were only alive to see you. Drawing back and pointing, Stephen said with bitterness, It is a symbol of Irish art, the cracked looking-glass of a servant. Buck Mulligan suddenly linked his arm in Stephen's and walked with him round the tower, his razor and mirror clacking in the pocket where he had thrust them. It's not fair to tease you like that, Kinch, is it? He said kindly. God knows you have more spirit than any of them. Parried again. He fears the lancet of my art, as I fear that of his, the cold steel pen. Cracked looking glass of the servant. Tell that to the oxy chap downstairs and touch him for a guinea. He's stinking with money and thinks you're not a gentleman. His elfella made his tin by selling jalap to Zulus or some bloody swindle or other. God, Kinch, if you and I could only work together, we might do something for the island. Hellenize it.
Cranley's arm. His arm.
And to think of your having to beg from these swine. I'm the only one that knows what you are. Why don't you trust me more? What have you got up your nose against me? Is it Haynes? If he makes any noise here, I'll bring down Seymour, and we'll give him a ragging worse than they gave Clive Kempthorpe.
Young shouts of moneyed voices in Clive Kempthorpe's rooms. Pale faces. They held their ribs with laughter, one clasping another.
Oh, I shall expire. Break the news to her gently, Aubrey. I shall die.
With slit ribbons of his shirt whipping the air, he hops and hobbles round the table, with trousers down at heels, chased by aides of Magdalen with the tailor's shears. A scared calf's face, gilded with marmalade.
I don't want to be debagged. Don't you play the giddy ox with me.
Shouts from the open window. Startling evening in the quadrangle. A deaf gardener, aproned, masked with Matthew Arnold's face, pushes his mower on the somber lawn, watching narrowly the dancing motes of grass arms. To ourselves, new paganism, Omphalos. Let him stay, Stephen said. There's nothing wrong with him except at night.
Then what is it? Buck Mulligan asked impatiently. Cough it up. I'm quite frank with you. What have you got against me now?
They halted, looking towards the blunt cape of grey head that lay on the water like the snout of a sleeping whale. Stephen freed his arm quietly. Do you wish me to tell you? He asked.
Yes, what is it? Buck Mulligan answered. I don't remember anything.
He looked in Stephen's face as he spoke. A light wind passed his brow, fanning softly his fair, uncombed hair and stirring silver points of anxiety in his eyes. Stephen, depressed by his own voice, said, Do you remember the first day I went to your house after my mother's death? Buck Mulligan frowned quickly and said,
What? Where? I can't remember anything. I remember only ideas and sensations. Why? What happened in the name of God?
You were making tea, Stephen said. And I went across the landing to get more hot water. Your mother and some visitor came out of the drawing-room. She asked you who was in your room.
Yes, Buck Mulligan said. What did I say? I forget.
You said, Stephen answered, Oh, it's only Daedalus, whose mother is beastly dead. A flush, which made him seem younger and more engaging, rose to Buck Mulligan's cheek.
Did I say that? He asked. Well, what harm is that?
He shook his constraint from him, nervously.
And what is death? He asked. Your mother's or yours or my own. You saw only your mother die. I see them pop up every day in the matter and enrichment and cut up into tripes in the dissecting room. It's a beastly thing and nothing else. It simply doesn't matter. You wouldn't kneel down to pray for your mother on her deathbed when she asked you. Why?
Because you have the cursed Jesuit strain in you, only it's injected the wrong way. To me it's all a mockery and beastly.
Her cerebral lobes are not functioning. She calls the doctor Sir Peter Teasel and picks buttercups off the quilt. Humour her till it's over.
You crossed her last wish in death, and yet you sulk with me because I don't whinge like some hired mute from Lalouette's.
Absurd! I suppose I did say it. I didn't mean to offend the memory of your mother.
He had spoken himself into boldness. Stephen, shielding the gaping wounds which the words had left in his heart, said very coldly,
I'm not thinking of the offence to my mother.
Of what, then?
Buck Mulligan asked.
Of the offence to me, Stephen answered.
Buck Mulligan swung round on his heel.
Oh, an impossible person, he exclaimed.
He walked off quickly round the parapet. Stephen stood at his post, gazing over the calm sea towards the headland. Sea and headland now grew dim. Pulses were beating in his eyes, veiling their sight, and he felt the fever of his cheeks. A voice within the tower called loudly,
"Are you up there, Mulligan? I'm coming!"
Buck Mulligan answered. He turned towards Stephen and said,
"Look at the sea. What does it care about offences? Chuck Loyola, Kinch, and come on down. The Sassenach wants his morning rashers."
His head halted again for a moment at the top of the staircase, level with the roof.
"Don't mope over it all day," he said. "I'm inconsequent. Give up the moody brooding."
His head vanished, but the drone of his descending voice boomed out of the stairhead.
"And no more turn aside and brood upon love's bitter mystery, for Fergus rules the brazen cards."
Wood shadows floated silently by through the morning peace from the stairhead seaward, where he gazed. Inshore and farther out, the mirror of water whitened, spurned by light-shod hurrying feet. White breast of the dim sea, the twining stresses two by two, a hand plucking the harp strings, merging their twining chords, wave-white wedded words shimmering on the dim tide. A cloud began to cover the sun slowly, shadowing the bay in deeper green. It lay behind him, a bowl of bitter waters. Fergus's song. I sang it alone in the house, holding down the long dark chords. Her door was open. She wanted to hear my music. Silent with awe and pity, I went to her bedside. She was crying in her wretched bed.
"For those words, Stephen, love's bitter mystery."
"Where now?" "Her secrets, old feather fans, tasseled dance cards powdered with musk, a gaud of amber beads in her locked drawer. A birdcage hung in the sunny window of her house when she was a girl. She heard old Roy sing in the pantomime of Turco the Terrible and laughed with others when he sang,
"I am the boy that can enjoy invisibility."
Phantasmal mirth folded away, musk-perfumed. And no more turn aside and brood. Folded away in the memory of nature with her toys. Memories beset his brooding brain. Her glass of water from the kitchen tap when she'd approached the sacrament. A cored apple filled with brown sugar roasting for her at the hob on a dark autumn evening. Her shapely fingernails reddened by the blood of squashed lice from the children's shirts. In a dream, silently, she had come to him. Her wasted body within its loose grave clothes giving off an odor of wax and rosewood. Her breath bent over him with mute secret words, a faint odor of wetted ashes. Her glazing eyes, staring out of death to shake and bend my soul on me alone. The ghost candle to light her agony. Ghostly light on the tortured face, her hoarse, loud breath rattling in horror while all prayed on their knees, her eyes on me, to strike me down. Liliata, rutilantium te confessorum turma circumdet, jubilantium te virginum chorus excipiat.
Ghoul, chewer of corpses, no mother, let me be and let me live! Kinch, ahoy!
Buck Mulligan's voice sang from within the tower. It came nearer, up the staircase, calling again. Stephen, still trembling at his soul's cry, heard warm, running sunlight, and in the air behind him, friendly words.
"Daedalus, come down like a good mosey. Breakfast is ready. Haynes is apologizing for waking us last night. It's all right."
"I'm coming," Stephen said, turning.
"Do, for Jesus' sake," Buck Mulligan said. "For my sake and for all our sakes."
His head disappeared and reappeared.
"I told him you're a symbol of Irish art. He says it's very clever. Touch him for a quid, will you? A guinea, I mean."
"I get paid this morning," Stephen said.
"The school kip," Buck Mulligan said. "How much? 4 quid? Lend us one."
if you want it, Stephen said.
4 shining sovereigns! Buck Mulligan cried with delight. We'll have a glorious drunk to astonish the Druidy Druids. 4 omnipotent sovereigns!
He flung up his hands and tramped down the stone stairs, singing out of tune with a Cockney accent.
Oh, won't we have a merry time, drinking whiskey, beer, and wine, on Coronation Day. Oh, won't we have a merry time on Coronation Day.
Mr. Leopold Bloom ate with relish the inner organs of beasts and fowls. He liked thick giblet soup, nutty gizzards, a stuffed roast heart, liver slices fried with crust crumbs, fried hen cod's roes. Most of all, he liked grilled mutton kidneys, which gave to his palate a fine tang of faintly scented urine. Kidneys were in his mind as he moved about the kitchen softly, writing her breakfast things on the humpy tray. Gelid light and air were in the kitchen, but out of doors, gentle summer morning everywhere. Made him feel a bit peckish. The coals were reddening. Another slice of bread and butter. 3, 4, right. She didn't like her plate full. Right. He turned from the tray, lifted the kettle off the hob, and set it sideways on the fire. It sat there, dull and squat, its spout stuck out. Cup of tea soon. Good. Mouth dry. The cat walked stiffly round a leg of the table, with tail on high.
Meow.
Oh, there you are, Mr. Bloom said, turning from the fire. The cat mewed in answer, and stalked again stiffly round a leg of the table, mewing. Just how she stalks over my writing table.
Brrr, scratch my head. Brrr.
Mr. Bloom watched curiously, kindly, the lithe black form. Clean to see. The gloss of her sleek hide, the white button under the butt of her tail, the green flashing eyes. He bent down to her, his hands on his knees.
Milk for the pussins?
He said.
Meow!
The cat cried. They called them stupid. They understand what we say better than we understand them. She understands all she wants to. Vindictive, too. Wonder what I look like to her. Height of a tower? No. She can jump me.
Afraid of the chickens she is, he said mockingly. Afraid of the chooks-chooks. I never saw such a stupid pussins as the pussins.
Cruel, her nature. Curious, mice never squeal. Seem to like it.
Meow,
the cat said loudly. She blinked up out of her avid, shame-closing eyes, mewing plaintively and long, showing him her milk-white teeth. He watched the dark eye slits narrowing with greed till her eyes were green stones. Then he went to the dresser, took the jug Hanlon's milkman had just filled for him, poured warm bubbled milk on a saucer, and set it slowly on the floor.
Brrr,
she cried, running to lap. He watched the bristles shining wirily in the weak light as she tipped 3 times and licked lightly. Wonder is it true if you clip them they can't mouse after? Why? They shine in the dark, perhaps, the tips. Or kind of feelers in the dark, perhaps. He listened to her licking lap. Ham and eggs, no good eggs with this drought. Want pure fresh water. Thursday, not a good day either for a mutton kidney at Buckley's, fried with butter, shake of pepper. Better a pork kidney at Lugas's, while the kettle is boiling. She lapped slower, then licking the saucer clean. Why are their tongues so rough? To lap better, all porous holes. Nothing she can eat. He glanced round him. No. On quietly creaky boots, he went up the staircase to the hall, paused by the bedroom door. She might like something tasty. Thin bread and butter she likes in the morning. Still, perhaps, once in a way. He said softly in the bare hall, I'm going round the corner. Be back in a minute. And when he had heard his voice say it, he added, You don't want anything for breakfast? A sleepy, soft grunt answered. She did not want anything. He heard then a warm, heavy sigh, softer, as she turned over and the loose brass quoits of the bedstead jingled. Must get those settled, really. Pity, all the way from Gibraltar. Forgotten any little Spanish she knew. Wonder what her father gave for it. Old style. Ah, yes, of course. Bought it at the governor's auction. Got a short knock. Hard as nails at a bargain, old Tweedy. Yes, sir. At Plavna that was. I rose from the ranks, sir, and I'm proud of it. Still, he had brains enough to make the corner in stamps. Now that was far-seeing. His hand took his hat from the peg over his initialled heavy overcoat and his lost property off a second-hand waterproof. Stamps, sticky-back pictures. Dare say lots of officers are in the swim, too. Of course they do. The sweated legend in the crown of his hat told him mutely, Plaistow's high-grade hat. He peeped quickly inside the leather headband. White slip of paper. Quite safe. On the doorstep, he felt in his hip pocket for the latch key. Not there. And the trousers I left off. Must get it. Potato I have. Creaky wardrobe. No use disturbing her. She turned over sleepily that time. He pulled the hall door, too, after him, very quietly. More, till the footleaf dropped gently over the threshold. A limp lid. Looked shut. All right till I come back anyhow. He crossed to the bright side, avoiding the loose cellar flap of number 75. The sun was nearing the steeple of George's Church. Be a warm day, I fancy. Especially in these black clothes, feel it more. Black conducts, reflects, refracts, is it, the heat. But I couldn't go in that light suit. Make a picnic out of it. He approached Larry O'Rourke's. From the cellar grating floated up the flabby gush of porter. Through the open doorway, the bar squirted out whiffs of ginger, tea dust, biscuit mush. Good house, however, just the end of the city traffic. For instance, Macaulay's down there, NG as a position. Of course, if they ran a tram line along the North Circular from the cattle market to the quays, value would go up like a shot. Bald head over the blind. Cute old codger. No use canvassing him for an ad. Still, he knows his own business best. There he is, sure enough, me bald Larry, leaning against the sugar bin in his shirt sleeves, watching the apron curate swab up with mop and bucket. Simon Dedalus takes him off to a tea, with eyes screwed up.
Do you know what I'm going to tell you?
What's that, Mr. O'Rourke?
Do you know what? The Russians. There'd only be an 8 o'clock breakfast for the Japanese.
Stop and say a word. About the funeral, perhaps. Sad thing about poor Digna, Mr. O'Rourke. Turning into Dorset Street, he said freshly in greeting through the doorway, Good day, Mr. O'Rourke.
Good day to you.
Lovely weather, sir.
Oh, 'tis all that.
Where did they get the money? Coming up red-headed curates from the County Leitrim, rinsing empties an old man in the cellar. Then, lo and behold, they blossom out as Adam Finlaters or Dan Talons. Then think of the competition. General thirst. Good puzzle would be to cross Dublin without passing a pub. Save it, they can't. Off the drunks, perhaps. Put down 3 and carry 5. What's that? A bob here and there, dribs and drabs. On the wholesale orders, perhaps. Doing a double shuffle with the town travellers. Square up at the boss, and we'd split the job, see? He halted before Glugas's window, staring at the hanks of sausages, polonies, black and white. 50 multiplied by... The figures whitened in his mind, unsolved. Displeased, he let them fade. The shiny links, packed with forcemeat, fed his gaze and he breathed in tranquilly the lukewarm breath of cooked, spicy pig's blood. A kidney oozed blood gouts on the willow-pattern dish, the last. He stood by the next-door girl at the counter. Would she buy it too? Calling the items from the slip in her hand. Chapped washing soda. And 1.5 pounds of Denny sausages. His eyes rested on her vigorous hips. Woods, his name is. Wonder what he does. Wife is oldish. New blood. No followers allowed. Strong pair of arms. Whacking a carpet on the clothesline. She does whack it, by George, the way her crooked skirt swings at each whack. The ferret-eyed pork butcher folded the sausages he had snipped off with blotchy fingers, sausage pink. Sound meat there, like a stall-fed heifer. He took up a page from the pile of cut sheets. The model farm at Kinnereth on the lake shore of Tiberias can become ideal winter sanatorium. Moses Montefiore. I thought he was. Farmhouse wall rounded, blurred cattle cropping. He held the page from him. Interesting. Read it nearer. The blurred cropping cattle. The page rustling. A young white heifer. Those mornings in the cattle market. The beasts lowing in their pens. Branded sheep, flop and fall of dung. The breeders in hobnailed boots trudging through the litter, slapping a palm on a ripe meat at hindquarters. There's a prime one. Unpeeled switches in their hands. He held the page aslant, patiently, bending his senses and his will, his soft subject gaze at rest. The crooked skirt swinging whack by whack by whack. The pork butcher snapped two sheets from the pile, wrapped up her prime sausages, and made a red grimace. "Now, my miss," he said. She tendered a coin, smiling boldly, holding her thick wrist out. "Thank you, my miss, and 1 shilling threepence change. For you, please." Mr. Bloom pointed quickly, to catch up and walk behind her as she went slowly, behind her moving hams. Pleasant to see first thing in the morning. Hurry up, damn it. Make hay while the sun shines. She stood outside the shop in sunlight, and sauntered lazily to the right. He sighed down his nose. They never understand. Soda-chapped hands. Crusted toenails, too. Brown scapulars and tatters defending her both ways. The sting of disregard glowed to weak pleasure within his breast. For another, a constable off duty cuddled her a necklace length. They liked them sizable. Prime sausage. "Oh, please, Mr. Policeman, I'm lost in the wood. Threepence, please." His hand accepted the moist, tendered land and slid it into a side pocket. Then it fetched up 3 coins from his trousers pocket and laid them on the rubber prickles. They lay, were read quickly, and quickly slid disc by disc into the till. "Thank you, sir. Another time." A speck of eager fire from fox eyes thanked him. He withdrew his gaze after an instant. "No, better not. Another time." "Good morning," he said, moving away. "Good morning, sir." No sign. Gone. What matter? He walked along Dorset Street, reading gravely. "Agendath na time. Planters Company. To purchase vast sandy tracts from Turkish government and plant with eucalyptus trees. Excellent for shade, fuel and construction. Orange groves and immense melon fields north of Jaffa. You pay 8 marks and they plant a dunam of land for you with olives, oranges, almonds or citrons. Olives cheaper. Oranges need artificial irrigation. Every year you get a sending of the crop. Your name entered for life as owner in the book of the union. Can pay 10 down and the balance in yearly instalments. Bleitraubstrasse, 34, Berlin, W15. Nothing doing. Still, an idea behind it. Folding the page into his pocket, he turned into Eccles Street, hurrying homeward. Number 80 still on let. Why is that? Valuation is only 28. Towers, Battersby, North, MacArthur. Parlour windows plastered with bills. Plasters on a sore eye. To smell the gentle smoke of tea, fume of the pan, sizzling butter. Be near her ample, bed-warmed flesh. Yes, yes. Quick warm sunlight came running down Berkeley Road, swiftly in slim sandals along the brightening footpath. Run, she runs to me, a girl with gold hair on the wind. Two letters and a card lay on the hall floor. He stopped and gathered them. Mrs. Marion Bloom. His quick heart slowed at once. Bold hand. Mrs. Marion.
Poldie!
Entering the bedroom, he half closed his eyes and walked through warm yellow twilight towards her tousled head.
Who are the letters for?
He looked at them. Mullingar. Millie.
A letter for me from Millie, he said carefully, and a card to you and a letter for you.
He laid her card and letter on the twill bedspread near the curve of her knees.
Do you want the blind up?
Letting the blind up by gentle tugs halfway, his backward eyes saw her glance at the letter and tuck it under her pillow.
That do?
He asked, turning. She was reading the card, propped on her elbow.
She got the things.
He waited till she had laid the card aside and curled herself back slowly with a snug sigh.
Hurry up with that tea. I'm parched.
The kettle is boiling,
he said. But he delayed to clear the chair, her striped petticoat, tossed soiled linen, and lifted all in an armful onto the foot of the bed. As he went down the kitchen stairs, she called.
Poldie!
What?
Scald the teapot!
On the boil, sure enough, a plume of steam from the spout. He scalded and rinsed out the teapot, and put in 4 full spoons of tea, tilting the kettle then to let the water flow in. Having set it to draw, he took off the kettle and crushed the pan flat on the live coals and watched the lump of butter slide and melt. While he unwrapped the kidney, the cat mewed hungrily against him. Give her too much meat, she won't mouse. Say they won't eat pork. Kosher. Here. He let the blood-smeared paper fall to her and dropped the kidney amid the sizzling butter sauce. Pepper. He sprinkled it through his fingers, ring-wise, from the chipped egg cup. Then he slit open his letter, glancing down the page and over. Thanks, New Town, Mr. Cotlin, Lock Owl Picnic, Young Student, Blazes Boylan's, Seaside Girls. The tea was drawn. He filled his own moustache cup, Sham Crown Derby, smiling. Silly Millie's birthday gift. Only 5 she was then. No, wait, 4. I gave her the amberoid necklace she broke, putting pieces of folded brown paper in the letterbox for her. He smiled, pouring. He prodded a fork into the kidney and slapped it over, then fitted the teapot on the tray. It hump-bumped as he took it up. Everything on it, bread and butter, 4 sugar spoon, her cream, yes. He carried it upstairs, his thumb hooked in the teapot handle. Nudging the door open with his knee, he carried the tray in and set it on the chair by the bedhead.
What a time you were!
She set the brasses jingling as she raised herself briskly, an elbow on the pillow. He looked calmly down on her bulk and between her large, soft bubs, sloping within her nightdress like a she-goat's udder. The warmth of her couched body rose on the air, mingling with the fragrance of the tea she poured. A strip of torn envelope peeped from under the dimpled pillow. In the act of going, he stayed to straighten the bedspread.
Who's the letter from?
Bold hand. Marion.
Oh, Boylan. He's bringing the programme.
What are you singing?
La Chi Darem with J.C. Doyle and Love's Old Sweet Song.
Her full lips, drinking, smiled. Rather stale smell that incense leaves next day, like foul flower water.
Would you like the window open a little?
She doubled a slice of bread into her mouth, asking,
What time is the funeral?
11, I think. I didn't see the paper.
Following the pointing of her finger, he took up a leg of her soiled drawers from the bed. No? Then a twisted grey garter looped round a stocking, rumpled shiny sole.
No, that book.
Other stocking. Her petticoat.
It must have fell down.
He felt here and there. Volio in onvere. I wonder if she pronounces that right. Volio. Not in the bed. It must have slid down. He stopped and lifted the valance. The book, fallen, sprawled against the bulge of the orange-keyed chamber pot.
Show here. I put a mark on it. There's a word I wanted to ask you.
She swallowed a draught of tea from her cup, held by another handle, and having wiped her fingertips smartly on the blanket, began to search the text with the hairpin till she reached the word.
Met him what?
Here. What does that mean?
He leaned downwards and read near her polished thumbnail.
Metempsychosis.
Yes. Who's he when he's at home?
Metempsychosis. It's Greek, from the Greek. That means the transmigration of souls.
Oh, rocks. Tell us in plain words.
He smiled, glancing askance at her mocking eye. Same young eyes. The first night after the charades, Dolphin's Barn. He turned over the smudged pages. Ruby, the pride of the ring. Hello. Illustration. Fierce Italian with carriage whip. Must be Ruby, pride of the... on the floor, naked. Sheet kindly lent. The monster of Maffei desisted and flung his victim from him with an oath. Cruelty behind it all. Doped animals. Trapeze at Hengler's. Had to look the other way. Mob gaping. Break your neck and we break our sides. Families of them. Born them young, so they metempsychosis. That we live after death, our souls. That a man's soul, after he dies. Dignam's soul.
Did you finish it?
Yes. There's nothing smutty in it. Is she in love with the first fellow all the time?
Never read it. Do you want another?
Yes. Get another of Paul de Kock's. Nice name he has.
She poured more tea into her cup, watching it flow sideways. Must get that Capel Street library book renewed, or they'll write to Carney, my guarantor. Reincarnation, that's the word.
Some people believe that we go on living in another body after death, that we live before. They call it reincarnation. That we all lived before on the earth thousands of years ago, or some other planet. They say we've forgotten it. Some say they remember their past lives.
The sluggish cream wound curling spirals through her tea. Better reminder of that word, metempsychosis. An example would be better. An example. The bath of the nymph over the bed. Given away with the Easter number of photo bits. Splendid masterpiece in art colours. Tea before you put milk in. Not unlike her, with her hair down. Slimmer. 3 and 6 I gave for the frame. She said it would look nice over the bed. Naked nymphs. Greece. And, for instance, all the people that lived then. He turned the pages back.
Metempsychosis is what the ancient Greeks called it. They used to believe you could be changed into an animal or a tree, for instance. What they call nymphs, for example.
Her spoon ceased to stir up the sugar. She gazed straight before her, inhaling through her arched nostrils.
There's a smell of burn. Did you leave anything on the fire?
Oh, the kidney,
he cried suddenly. He fitted the book roughly into his inner pocket and, stubbing his toe against the broken commode, hurried out towards the smell, stepping hastily down the stairs with a flurried stork's legs. Pungent smoke shot up in an angry jet from a side of the pan. By prodding a prong of the fork under the kidney, he detached it and turned a turtle on its back. That's only a little burned. He tossed it off the pan onto a plate and let the scanty brown gravy trickle over it. Cup of tea now. He sat down, cut and buttered a slice of loaf. He shore away the burned flesh and flung it to the cat. Then he put a forkful into his mouth, chewing with discernment the toothsome, pliant meat. Done to a turn. A mouthful of tea. Then he cut away dies of bread, sopped one in the gravy, and put it in his mouth. What was that about some young student and a picnic? He creased out the letter at his side, reading it slowly as he chewed, sopping another die of bread in the gravy, and raising it to his mouth. The cat, having cleaned all her fur, returned to the meat-stained paper, nosed at it, and stalked to the door. She looked back at him, mewing. Wants to go out. Wait before a door. Sometimes it will open. Let her wait. Has the fidgets. Electric, thunder in the air. Was washing at her ear with her back to the fire, too. He felt heavy, full. Then a gentle loosening of his bowels. He stood up, undoing the waistband of his trousers. The cat mewed to him.
Meow, he said, in answer. Wait till I'm ready.
Heaviness. Hot day coming. Too much trouble to fag up the stairs to the landing. A paper. He liked to read at stool. Hope no apes comes knocking just as I'm... In the table drawer he found an old number of Titbits. He folded it under his armpit, went to the door and opened it. The cat went up in soft bounds. Ah, wanted to go upstairs, curled up in a ball on the bed. Listening, he heard her voice.
Come, come, pussy, come.
He went out through the back door into the garden, stood to listen towards the next garden. No sound. Perhaps hanging clothes out to dry? The maid was in the garden. Fine morning. He kicked open the crazy door of the Jakes. Better be careful not to get these trousers dirty for the funeral. He went in, bowing his head under the low lintel. Leaving the door ajar, amid the stench of mouldy lime wash and stale cobwebs, he undid his braces. Before sitting down, he peered through a chink up at the next-door window. The king was in his counting-house. Nobody. A squat on the cockstool, he folded out his paper, turning its pages over on his bared knees. Something new and easy, no great hurry. Keep it a bit. Our prize Titbit. Matron's Masterstroke, written by Mr. Philip Beaufoy, Playgoers Club, London. Payment at the rate of 1 guinea a column has been made to the writer. 3.5, £3, £3, £3.30 and 6. He tore away half the prize story sharply and wiped himself with it. Then he girded up his trousers, braced and buttoned himself. He pulled back the jerky, shaky door of the Jakes and came forth from the gloom into the air. In the bright light, lightened and cooled in limb, he eyed carefully his black trousers, the ends, the knees, the hocks of the knees. What time is the funeral? Oh, I better find out in the paper. A creak and a dark whir in the air high up. The bells of George's Church. They tolled the hour. Loud, dark iron.
Hey-ho, 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 hey-ho.
1:45. There again, the overtone following through the air. 3rd. Poor Dignam. By Lurie's, along Sir John Rogerson's quay, Mr. Bloom walked soberly, past Windmill Lane, Leask's, the Linseed Crushers, the Postal Telegraph Office. Could have given that address, too. And past the Sailor's Home. He turned from the morning noises of the quayside and walked through Lime Street. By Brady's cottages, a boy for the skins lolled, his bucket of offal linked, smoking a chewed fagbutt. A smaller girl with scars of eczema on her forehead eyed him listlessly, holding her battered cask hoop. Tell him if he smokes he won't grow. Ah, let him. His life isn't such a bed of roses, waiting outside pubs to bring Da home. Come home to Ma, Da. Slack hour. Won't be many there. He crossed Townsend Street, passing the frowning face of Bethel. L, yes, house of Aleph Bet. And past Nichols, the undertaker's. At 11 it is. Time enough. Dare say Corny Keller have bagged that job for O'Neill's. Singing with his eyes shut. Corny. Met her once in the park, in the dark, what a lark. Police tout. Her name and address she then told, with my tirulum tirulum tay. Oh, surely he bagged it. Bury him cheap in a whatchamacall. With me tirulum 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 tirulum. In Westland Row, he halted before the window of the Belfast and Oriental Tea Company and read the legends of lead-papered packets. Choice blend, finest quality, family tea. Oh, it's rather warm. Tea. Must get some from Tom Kernan. Couldn't ask him at the funeral, though. While his eyes still read blandly, he took off his hat, quietly inhaling his hair oil, and sent his right hand with slow grace over his brow and hair. Very warm morning. Under their dropped eyelids, his eyes found the tiny bow of the leather headband inside his high-grade hat. Just there. His right hand came down into the bowl of his hat. His fingers found quickly a card behind the headband and transferred it to his waistcoat pocket. So warm. His right hand once more slowly, went over again. Choice blend, made of the finest Ceylon brand. The Far East. Lovely spot it must be. The garden of the world. Big, lazy leaves to float about on. Cactus. Flowery meads. Snaky liane, as they call them. Wonder is it like that? Those Cingalese lobbing about in the sun, in dulce far niente. Not doing a hand's turn all day. Sleep 6 months out of 12. Too hot to quarrel. Influence of the climate. Lethargy. Flowers of idleness. The air feeds most. Azotes. Hothouse and botanic garden. Sensitive plants. Water lilies. Petals too tired to... Sleeping sickness in the air. Walk on rose leaves. Imagine trying to eat tripe and cowheel. Where was the chap I saw in that picture somewhere? Ah, in the Dead Sea. Floating on his back. Reading a book with the parasol open. Couldn't sink if you tried. So thick with salt. Because the weight of the water, no, the weight of the body in the water is equal to the weight of the... Or is it the volume is equal to the weight? It's a law, something like that. Vance in high school, cracking his finger joints, teaching. The college curriculum, cracking curriculum. What is weight, really, when you say the weight? 32 feet per second, law of falling bodies per second. They all fall to the ground, the earth. It's the force of gravity of the earth is the weight. He turned away and sauntered across the road. How did she walk with her sausages? Like that something. As he walked, he took the folded Freeman from his side pocket, unfolded it, rolled it lengthwise in a baton, and tapped it at each sauntering step against his trouser leg. Careless air. Just drop in and see. Per second, for every second it means. From the curbstone, he darted a keen glance to the door of the post office. Too late, box. Post here. No one. In. He handed the card to the brass grill. Are there any letters for me? He asked. While the postmistress searched a pigeonhole, he gazed at the recruiting poster with soldiers of all arms on parade, and held the tip of his baton against his nostrils, smelling fresh-printed rag paper. No answer, probably. Went too far last time. The postmistress handed him back through the grill his card with a letter. He thanked and glanced rapidly at the typed envelope. Henry Flower, Esquire, care of P.O., Westland Row, City. Answered, anyhow. He slipped card and letter into his side pocket, reviewing again the soldiers on parade. He strolled out of the post office and turned to the right. Talk, as if that would mend matters. His hand went into his pocket, and a forefinger felt its way under the flap of the envelope, ripping it open in jerks. Women will pay a lot of heed, I don't think. His fingers drew forth the letter and crumpled the envelope in his pocket. Something pinned on. Photo, perhaps. Hair? No. Oh, McCoy. Get rid of him quickly. Take me out of me way. Hate company when you... Hello, Bloom! Where are you off to? Oh, hello, McCoy. Nowhere in particular. How's the body? Fine. How are you? Oh, just keeping alive, McCoy said. His eyes on the black tie and clothes, he asked with low respect. Is there any, no trouble, I hope. I see you're... Oh, no, Mr. Bloom said. Poor Dignam, you know. The funeral is today. Ah, to be sure. Poor fella, so it is. What time? A photo, it isn't. A badge, maybe. 11, Mr. Bloom answered. I must try to get out there, McCoy said. 11 is a... I only heard it last night. Who was telling me? Holohan, you know Hoppy. I know. Mr. Bloom gazed across the road at the outsider drawn up before the door of the Grosvenor. The porter hoisted the valise up onto the well. She stood still, waiting, while the man, husband, brother, like her, searched his pockets for change. Stylish kind of coat with that roll collar. Warm for a day like this. Looks like blanket cloth. Careless stand over with their hands in those patch pockets. Like that haughty creature at the polo match. Women all for caste till you touch the spot. Handsome is and handsome does. Reserve about to yield. The honourable Mrs. and Brutus is an honourable man. Possess her once, take the starch out of her.
Well, I was with Bob Dorden. He's on one of his periodical bends. What do you call them? Bantam lions. Just down there in Conway's we were.
Doran lions in Conway's. She raised a gloved hand to her hair.
In come Hoppy having a wet.
Drawing back his head and gazing far from beneath his veiled eyelids, he saw the bright fawn skin shine in the glare, the braided drums. Clearly I can see today. Moisture about gives long sight, perhaps.
Talking of one thing or another.
Lady's hand. Which side will she get up?
Sad thing about our poor friend Paddy. What Paddy? I said. Poor little Paddy Dingham, he said.
Off to the country. Broadstown, probably. High brown boots with laces dangling. Well-turned foot. What is he foosting over that change for? Sees me looking. Eyes out for other fellas always. Good fallback. Two strings to a bow.
Why, I said, what's wrong with him, I said.
Proud, rich, silk stockings.
Yes,
Mr. Bloom said. He moved a little to the side of McCoy's talking head, getting up in a minute.
What's wrong with him, he said. He's dead, he said, and fate he filled up. Is it Paddy Dignam, I said? I couldn't believe it when I heard it. I was with him the lady on Friday last, or Thursday, was it, in the arch. Yes, he said, he's gone. He died on Monday, poor fella.
Watch, watch. Silk flash, rich stockings, white, watch. A heavy tram car, honking its gong, slewed between.
Lost it.
Curse your noisy pug nose. Feels locked out of it. Paradise on the Perry. Always happened like that. The very moment. Girl in Eustace Street hallway Monday, was it? Settling her garter. Her friend covering the display of esprit de corps.
Well, what are you gaping at?
Yes, yes, Mr. Bloom said, after a dull sigh. Another gone.
Oh, one of the best, McCoy said.
The tram passed. They drove off towards the Loop Line Bridge, her rich gloved hand on the steel grip. Flicker, flicker, the lace flare of her hat in the sun. Flicker, flick.
Wife well, I suppose? McCoy's changed voice said.
Oh, yes, Mr. Bloom said.
Tip-top, thanks.
He unrolled the newspaper baton idly and read idly. What is home without plum trees, potted meat, incomplete? With it, an abode of bliss.
My missus has just got an engagement. At least it's not settled yet.
Felice Tack again. By the way, no harm. I'm off that, thanks. Mr. Bloom turned his large-lidded eyes with unhasty friendliness.
My wife, too, he said. She's going to sing at a swagger affair in the Ulster Hall, Belfast, on the 25th.
That's so,
McCoy said.
Glad to hear that, old man. Who's getting it up?
Mrs. Marion Bloom. Not up yet. Queen was in her bedroom, eating bread and... No book. Blackened court cards laid along her thigh by sevens. Dark lady and fair man. Cat. Furry black ball. Torn strip of envelope. Love's old sweet song. Comes love's old. It's a kind of a tour, don't you see? Mr. Bloom said thoughtfully. Sweet song. There's a committee formed, part shares and part profits. McCoy nodded, picking at his moustache stubble.
Oh, well, he said, that's good news.
He moved to go.
Well, glad to see you looking fit, he said. Meet you knocking around.
Yes, Mr. Bloom said.
Tell you what, McCoy said. You might put my name down at the funeral, will you? I'd like to go, but I mightn't be able, you see. There's a drowning case of Sandy Cove may turn up, and then the coroner and myself would have to go down if the body is found. You just shove in my name if I'm not there, will you?
I'll do that, Mr. Bloom said, moving to get off. That'll be all right.
Right, McCoy said brightly. Thanks, old man. I'd go if I possibly could. Well, tell all. Just C.P. McCoy will do.
That will be done, Mr. Bloom answered firmly. Mr. Bloom, strolling towards Brunswick Street, smiled. My missus has just got an reedy freckle soprano, cheese-paring nose. Nice enough in its way, for a little ballad. No guts in it.
You and me, don't you know, in the same boat.
Soft-soaping. Give you the needle, that would. Can't he hear the difference? I think he's that way inclined a bit. Against migraine, somehow. Thought that Belfast would fetch him. I hope that smallpox up there doesn't get worse.
Suppose she wouldn't let herself be vaccinated again.
Your wife and my wife.
I wonder, is he pimping after me? He passed the cabman's shelter. Curious, the life of drifting cabbies, all weathers, all places, time or set down, no will of their own. Roll your way on. Like to give them an odd cigarette. Sociable. Shout a few flying syllables as they pass. He hummed. La chi da rem la mano. La 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 la.
He turned into Cumberland Street, and going on some paces, halted in the lee of the station wall. No one. Meade's timber yard. Piled box. Ruins and tenements. With careful tread he passed over a hopscotch court with its forgotten picky stone. Not a sinner. Near the timber yard, a squatted child at marbles alone, shooting the tor with a cunny thumb. A wise tabby, a blinking sphinx, watched from her warm sill. Pity to disturb them. Muhammad cut a piece out of his mantle not to wake her. Open it. And once I played marbles, when I went to the old dame's school. She liked mignonette. Mrs. Ellis and Mr. He opened the letter within the newspaper. A flower? I think it's a yellow flower with flattened petals. Not annoyed, then. What does she say? Dear Henry, I got your last letter to me, and thank you very much for it. I am sorry you did not like my last letter. Why did you enclose the stamps? I am awfully angry with you. I do wish I could punish you for that. I called you naughty boy because I do not like that other word. Please tell me, what is the real meaning of that word? Are you not happy in your home, you poor little naughty boy? I do wish I could do something for you. Please tell me what you think of poor me. I often think of the beautiful name you have. Dear Henry, when will we meet? I think of you so often you have no idea. I have never felt myself so much drawn to a man as you. I feel so bad about. Please write me a long letter and tell me more. Remember, if you do not, I will punish you. So now you know what I will do to you, you naughty boy, if you do not write. Oh, how I long to meet you. Henry, dear, do not deny my request before my patience are exhausted. Then I will tell you all. Goodbye now, naughty darling. I have such a bad headache today, and write by return to your longing, Martha. P.S. Do tell me, what kind of perfume does your wife use? I want to know. He tore the flower gravely from its pinhold, smelt its almost no smell, and placed it in his heart pocket. Language of flowers. They like it, because no one can hear. Or a poisoned bouquet to strike him down. Then walking slowly forward, he read the letter again, murmuring here and there a word. Angry tulips with you, darling manflower. Punish our cactus, if you don't please, poor forget-me-not. How I long violets to dear roses, when we soon an enemy meet, all naughty night-stalk wife, Martha's perfume. Having read it all, he took it from the newspaper and put it back in his side pocket. How goes the time? A quarter past, time enough yet. Better get that lotion made up. Where is this? Ah, yes, the last time. Sweeney's in Lincoln Place. Chemists rarely move. Their green and gold beacon jars too heavy to stir. Hamilton Long's founded in the year of the flood. Huguenot churchyard near there. Visit some day. He walked southward along Westland Row. But the recipe is in the other trousers. Oh, and I forgot that latchkey, too. Bore, this funeral affair. Oh, well, poor fellow. It's not his fault. When was it I got it made up last? Wait, I changed a sovereign, I remember. First of the month it must have been, or the second. Oh, we can look it up in the prescriptions book. The chemist turned back page after page. Sandy shriveled smell he seems to have. Shrunken skull. And old. Quest for the Philosopher's Stone. The alchemists.
About a fortnight ago, sir.
Yes, Mr. Broome said. He waited by the counter, inhaling the keen reek of drugs, the dusty, dry smell of sponges and loofahs. Lot of time taken up telling your aches and pains. Sweet almond oil and tincture of benzoin, Mr. Broome said, and then orange flower water. It certainly did make her skin so delicate, white like wax, and white wax also, he said. Brings out the darkness of her eyes, looking at me, the sheet up to her eyes, Spanish. Smelling herself. when I was fixing the links in my cuffs. Those homely recipes are often the best. Strawberries for the teeth, nettles and rainwater, oatmeal, they say, steeped in buttermilk. Skin food. One of the old Queen's sons, Duke of Albany, was it? Had only one skin. Leopold, yes. Three we have. Warts, bunions and pimples, to make it worse. But you want a perfume, too. What perfume does your Peau d'Espagne? That orange flower. Pure curd soap. Water is so fresh. Nice smell these soaps have. Time to get a bath around the corner. Hammam. Turkish massage. Dirt gets rolled up in your navel. Nicer if a nice girl did it. Also, I think I... Yes, I do it in the bath. Curious longing. Water to water. Combine business with pleasure. Pity no time for massage. Feel fresh then all day. Funeral be rather glum.
Yes, sir,
the chemist said.
That was 2 and 9. Have you brought a bottle?
No, Mr. Bloom said. Make it up, please. I'll call later in the day, and I'll take one of those soaps. How much are they?
4 pence, sir.
Mr. Bloom raised a cake to his nostrils. Sweet, lemony wax. I'll take this one, he said. That makes 3 and a penny.
Yes, sir, the chemist said. You can pay altogether, sir, when you come back.
Good, Mr. Bloom said. He strolled out of the shop, the newspaper baton under his armpit, the cool wrappered soap in his left hand. At his armpit, Bantam Lyons' voice and hand said,
Hello, Bloom. What's the best news? Is that today's show's a minute?
Shaved off his moustache again, by Jove. Long, cold upper lip, to look younger. He does look balmy, younger than I am. Bantam Lyons' yellow black-nailed fingers unrolled the baton. Wants a wash, too. Take off the rough dirt. Good morning. Have you used pear soap? Dandruff on his shoulders. Scalp wants oiling.
I want to see about the French horse that's running today, Bantam Lyons said. Where the bugger is it?
He rustled the pleated pages, jerking his chin on his high collar. Barber's itch. Tight collar. He loses hair. Better leave him the paper and get shut of him.
You can keep it, Mr. Bloom said. Ascot Gold Cup. Wait,
Bantam Lyons muttered. Half a mo. Maximum the second. I was just going to throw it away, Mr. Bloom said. Bantam Lyons raised his eyes suddenly and leered weakly.
What's that?
His sharp voice said. I said you can keep it, Mr. Bloom answered. I was going to throw it away that moment. Bantam Lyons doubted an instant, leering, then thrust the outspread sheets back on Mr. Bloom's arms.
I'll risk it, he said. Here, thanks.
He sped off towards Conway's corner. Godspeed, scut. Mr. Bloom folded the sheets again to a neat square and lodged the soap in it, smiling. Silly lips of that chap. Betting. Regular hotbed of it lately. Messenger boy stealing to put on sixpence. Raffle for large tender turkey. Your Christmas dinner for 3 pence. Jack Fleming embezzling to gamble, then smuggled off to America. Keeps a hotel now. They never come back. Flesh pots of Egypt. He walked cheerfully towards the Mosque of the Baths. Reminds you of a mosque, red-baked bricks, the minarets. College sports today, I see. He eyed the horseshoe poster over the gate of College Park. Cyclist doubled up like a cod in a pot. Damn bad ad. Now, if they had made it round like a wheel, then the spokes, sports, 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 and the hub, big, college. Something to catch the eye. Oh, there's Hornblower standing at the porter's lodge. Keep him on hand. Might take a turn in there on the nod.
How do you do, Mr. Hornblower? How do you do, sir?
Heavenly weather, really. If life was always like that. Cricket weather. Sit around under sunshades. Over after over. Out. They can't play it here. Duck for 6 wickets. Still, Captain Buller broke a window in the Kildare Street Club with a slog to square leg. Donnybrook Fair, more on their line. And the skulls we wear recracked when McCarthy took the floor. Heat wave. Won't last. Always passing the stream of life, which in the stream of life we trace is dearer than them all. Enjoy a bath now. Clean trough of water, cool enamel, the gentle, tepid stream. This is my body. He foresaw his pale body, reclined in it at full, naked, in a womb of warmth, oiled by scented, melting soap, softly laved. He saw his trunk and limbs rippled over and sustained, buoyed lightly upward, lemon yellow, his navel, bud of flesh, and saw the dark tangled curls of his bush floating, floating hair of the stream, around the limp father of thousands, a languid, floating flower.